listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 40th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. And actually, we are now going to be moving into a look at the history of relations between the Soviet Union and China as the break between the two after Nikita Khrushchev turned the party around, the Communist Party around almost 180 degrees in the Soviet Union, caused a break with the Chinese Communist Party and some things that still echo today. Luciana, pleasure to have you.
My pleasure, as usual, Don. Yes, we were going to talk about the Sino-Soviet split, the break between the Soviet Communist Party and the Chinese Communist Party, which actually took a decade from 1956 to 1966. Right. And so it was a long period of tension, an unofficial break. When Khrushchev made his infamous secret report to closed doors to members, to delegates of the Communist Party in 1956, we talked about this. During this secret report, he issued a de-Stalinization denunciation, and also announced peaceful coexistence with the capitalist West. So Mao Zedong reacted to these two turnarounds.
You know what? Let me give audience. No, because our audience is a lot younger than I am, certainly, and didn't live through a lot of this stuff. What we're talking about is first Khrushchev, when he gave the speech condemning Stalin and the period of Stalin's governance in the Soviet Union. He was adopting essentially a line that had been the line of those opposed to the Soviet Union around the world that called themselves socialists or communists. It was the Trotsky line. It was also the line of other socialist parties that were opposed to the Soviet government and to the Soviet Union. Where they would break down generally these groups on foreign policy was they would side with the United States and the European imperial powers against the Soviet Union, almost on each and every issue. It was couched in Marxist and socialist-sounding rhetoric, but in essence, on the question of international relations, it was an anti-Soviet position. And now this was what was being taken by the leadership of the Soviet Union and also being introduced to the communist parties, the international, around the world. And China said, hello, wait a minute, what's going on here? So that's kind of the context for this that, you know, we've discussed in some depth earlier, but just so people understand
exactly
what we're picking up.
Yeah, exactly. With the discussion in some depth earlier, they sort of stumped me now in terms of summary, but you're exactly right. The issue was that China asked, what's going on? Are we Marxist-Leninist, or what are we?
Right.
So this, in 1961, the Communist Party of China finally, and that would be, in 1961, denounced Khrushchev communism as the product of revisionist traitors.
Yep.
He called the clique around Khrushchev revisionist traitors. Now, in the West, this split was portrayed as a struggle for power. If you look at Wikipedia, for example, it says the Sino-Soviet split was about who would lead the revolution of world communism.
Right.
To whom China or Russia would the vanguard parties of the world turn for aid and assistance?
Right.
In that vein, the USSR and the PRC competed for ideological leadership through their respective networks of Communist Party, etc.
Right.
So this is portrayed in the West as a struggle for a single party's power over the world communism and world communist parties. This is completely wrong, because the struggle was over the nature of Marxist-Leninism.
Right.
As Mao explains in the letter that I want, from which I want to quote extensively today. So,
there's one other piece of context. Now, I hope this doesn't throw you a curve, but this is an interesting thing to consider also. We're talking about 1956. This is just after Bandung Conference, the rise of the non-aligned movement. We are a few years into the post-war decolonization period that's going on. There are anti-imperialist uprisings taking place in colonies across the world, and you have, in essence, first a competition between the socialist countries, which are anti-imperialist by the ideology, the Marxist ideology that we're discussing, or the imperialist or former imperialist powers that are spreading now decolonization and democracy. As if, here, you can now run your government. We just want to continue to own your stuff. Inside that context, if you look at the nature of imperialism in its history, it essentially comes from Europe and spreads across the world. And there was, at the same time that Khrushchev was talking about, let's forget about being anti-imperialist, let's do accommodation with the West, let's do peaceful coexistence, as the colonies were rising up themselves, China was saying, hey, you know what, we're not Europeans and neither are they, and we're with them. And so there was this racial dynamic to it, and a colonized aspect to it that was not even the background to it. It's just swimming in that context.
Yeah, exactly. At the we're talking, so 1956 to 1966 is the period of the break, but as you point out, the crucial events of the era were the efforts at decolonization, and so for the Khrushchev gang, as I call it, to call for peaceful coexistence when the imperialist power were anything but peaceful was in essence a betrayal of Lenin in particular, imperialism.
Right.
So in 56, Khrushchev launches demonization of Stalin, de-Stalinization crusade. And in 1961, which was the last time that China participated in the Congress of Communist Party in Moscow, it was really the symbolic break in 61. And so they reiterated in that Congress in 1961, the Soviet Communist Party, now under leadership of Khrushchev, reiterated the accusations and reinforced the accusation against Stalinism. And what Mao argued was that the Chinese Communist Party had consistently over this period between 1956 and 1961 had consistently maintained that the question of how to evaluate Stalin and what attitude to take towards him is just not one of appraising Stalin himself. More importantly, it was a question of how to sum up the historical experience of the dictatorship of the proletariat and of the international communist movement since Lenin's death. And this is what the Chinese party continued to insist on having clarified. That is, okay, you accuse Stalin, but what about the experience of the dictatorship of the proletariat? And during the 22nd Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Sino-Soviet split therefore hardened, especially due to this de-Stalinization efforts, and but the words of which were peaceful coexistence, the USSR is the state of all the people. In essence, Khrushchev was saying that there was no remnant of the class struggle in the Soviet Union, at the same time that he was actually conducting policies that split the industrial workers, that is the proletarians, from the agricultural workers by separating in municipal areas, you know, by forming committees for industrial workers and committees for agricultural workers, in effect, trying to establish two parties. Whereas, you know, the efforts of Lenin from the beginning had been to unite the two, because that's where the success of the revolution actually was in question. I mean, the unity of peasants and workers. And
right.
So at the same time that he was saying the class struggle is over and we are the Soviet Union is the state of all the people, he was actually forming these two, soliciting these two parties, so in confusion and disorientation. And finally, of course, in 1964, he was pushed out of power. So on the question of Stalin, Mao wrote a open letter, which was published in the People's Daily of China. And this question of Stalin was a second comment on the open letter of the Central Committee of the Soviet Union soon after 1956. He had to write a second comment because the Soviet Union ignored the questions such as I have just summarized, and, you know, just continued to ignore it. So, and on the 31st of October of, I think, 1961, Stalin's body was removed from the Lenin mausoleum, and Stalin officially became a genocidal tyrant. So Mao's letter of 1964 spells out the consequences of this de-Stalinization, this second comment. So he says, as the train of events since the 20th Congress in 1956 fully show, the complete negation of Stalin by the leadership of the Soviet Union has had extremely serious consequences. The number one consequence has been that it has provided the imperialists, this is Mao writing, and the reactionaries of all countries with exceedingly welcome anti-Soviet and anti-communist ammunition. He writes that shortly after the 20th Congress, the imperialists exploited Khrushchev's secret anti-Stalin report to stir up worldwide tidal wave against the Soviet Union and against communism. So he also, I mean, Tito, this is my words now, Khrushchev accused Stalin of mocking up relations with Tito's Yugoslavia. At the same time, of course, Khrushchev is mocking up relations with Mao's China. So Mao says the imperialists, the reactionary of all countries, the Tito clique, and the opportunists of various descriptions all leapt at the chance to attack the Soviet Union, the Communist Party, and the Socialist camp. So many fraternal parties and countries were placed in serious difficulties. That's the result, number one. The second result was that, I quote Mao, the frantic campaign against Stalin by the leadership of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union enabled the Trotskyites, who had long been political corpses, to come to life again and clamor for the rehabilitation of Trotsky. In November 1961, writes Mao, at the conclusion of the 22nd Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the International Secretariat of the so-called Fourth International, that is Trotsky's International, stated in a letter to the 22nd Congress that in 1937, Trotsky said, a monument would be erected to the honor of the victims of Stalin.
Right.
And Mao says that the Fourth International continued. Today, this prediction has come true.
Right.
Before your Congress, the first secretary of your party has promised the erection of this monument.
Yep.
So, as a matter of fact, I was going to start by saying this, by framing the whole discussion of the Sino-Soviet split with what happened last year in Russia. On October 10th, 2017, President Vladimir Putin inaugurated a monument to the victim of Stalinist purges. That wasn't his initiative. It was the initiative of some human rights, Russian human rights group. But nevertheless, he attended, he attended this monument to the victims of Stalinist purges, which was called the Wall of Grief.
Yep.
And is placed on the outskirts of Moscow. And the Reuters reported this, saying that nearly 700,000 people were executed during the Great Terror of 37-38. And Reuters says, according to conservative official estimates, but those were the people who had been arrested.
Right.
So, you know, and Reuters then adds that, unfortunately, in their tone, monuments and memorial plaques honoring Stalin has sprung up in different Russian regions. State-approved textbooks have softened his image, and an opinion poll in June of 2017 crowned him the country's most outstanding historical figure. So what we see is, revisionism on one hand,
right,
that is Stalin the demon, victims, etc., and on the other hand, popular feelings turning towards the figure of Stalin. So,
yep.
And we have to observe, too, that there are no monuments to the victims of Stalin in China,
right,
that I know of. Do you?
That's right, and not only that, one really important point is, even though Mao's writing in, 1963, I guess, that we're reading from?
63, 64, yeah, it's hard to remember.
So he talks about that the demand made that Trotsky be, that the Trotsky's name be engraved on this monument. This is happening, you know, he's predicting that this monument will take, you know, be built back in 63, it is. And,
That's right.
And that's 10 years after Stalin died in 53. Okay, and it took until 2017 for them to actually build it. That's where the real public support is. It was 64 years after Stalin's death that Trotsky finally got his monument.
Sort of.
Okay.
He has failed to gain rehabilitation to this day, though.
That's right, of course. And there's also 26 years after the Soviet Union ceased to exist. It still took 26 years to do that.
Yeah. It's just, and then the third consequence that Mao enumerates is the all-out application of a revisionist line. This, the demonization of Stalin in the secret report led to a revisionism of Soviet history. So he writes, Stalin died in 53. 3 years later, the leaders of the Soviet Communist Party violently attacked him at the 20th Congress. And
right,
8 years after his death, they again did so at the 22nd Congress,
right,
in 61, removing and burning his remains. And he writes,
right,
continues to write, Mao, in repeating their violent attacks on Stalin, the leaders of the Soviet Communist Party aimed at erasing the indelible influence of this great proletarian revolutionary among the people of the Soviet Union and throughout the world, and paving the way for negating Marxism-Leninism, which Stalin had defended and developed, and thus initiate the season of all-out application of a revisionist line.
Yep.
Do you see how far-seeing my...
Yeah.
It just supports what you just said.
Yep.
And this revisionism, of course, is the same as counter-revolution, that is, rewriting the history of the revolution in a Western... what do you call it, acceptable way.
Well, it's a tactic of implementing a counter-revolution, in essence. I mean, what you're doing, in essence, is saying...
Yeah, and then you rewrite
history. Yeah, you rewrite the history so that you can tell people, you know, all those things, you know, you lack this or you need that or whatever. It's not, because the capitalist countries have encircled us and had declared war on us at the beginning and all these other things, murdered tens of millions of us. It's because of Stalin. It's Stalin's fault.
Yeah.
So the things that you were holding dear to you that are the result of Stalin helping to organize a fight against these people that have been doing this to you, now listen to the people that were doing it. They're telling you Stalin's the bandit and that's what should happen. And guess what? The people didn't buy it because it took them 64 years to erect one single monument to those quote-unquote victims.
Yeah. And so the revisionist line, writes Mao, began exactly with the 20th Congress and became fully systematized at the 22nd Congress. The facts have shown ever more clearly that their revision of the Marxist-Leninist theories on imperialism, war and peace, proletarian revolution, and the dictatorship of the proletariat, revolution in the colonies, the semi-colonies, is inseparably connected with their complete negation of Stalin.
Right.
So the fourth, so much to say, the fourth consequence is also interesting, because this is probably the most important. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to intrude here with the thought that I had lost. It's also interesting that Stalin, who led victory against imperialist Germany, supported by, you know, the Western powers, was then demonized. I mean, his reputation at the beginning of the Cold War, let's say between 45 and 50, his reputation was high very much across the world.
Right.
So to denigrate him, to demonize him, was to play right in the hands of those cold warriors that were setting out to contain communism. It's interesting to see how, time-wise, Khrushchev's action dovetails with the intentions of the imperialist powers, at the head of which is the United States, to contain, which is a polite word, to destroy communism in the world.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to say, that this was important. The demonization of Stalin was important because Stalin was such a respected figure.
Yeah.
Up until 1953, up until his death, right?
Yeah.
So then Mao goes on, and the fourth consequence, which is the most important for China, for communist parties all over the world, Mao writes, in launching the combat against the personality cult, the leaders of the Soviet Communist Party are not out to restore what they call, quote, the Leninist standard of party life and principles of leadership. He says, on the contrary, they are violating Lenin's teaching, and this is important, on the interrelationship of leaders, party, class, and masses, and contravening the principle of democratic centralism in the party. He explains this very clearly. He says, this principle of democratic centralism. He says, Marxist-Leninists maintain that if the Revolutionary Party of the Proletariat is genuine to serve as the headquarters of the proletariat in struggle, it must correctly handle the interrelationship of leaders, party, class, and masses, and must be organized on the principle of democratic centralism. Such a party must have a fairly stable nucleus of leadership. This is Lenin arguing against Trotsky in 1903.
Right.
Such a party must have a fairly stable nucleus of leadership, which should consist of a group of long-tested leaders who are good at integrating the universal truths of Marxism-Leninism with the concrete practice of revolution.
Right.
In other words, the party needs leaders not to lead the people, but to be in touch and to work with the people and to come out of their experience and to know the philosophy, if you want to call it that, of Marxism-Leninism. And just, I think this is so important that I want to quote some more. Mao writes that the leaders of the Proletarian Party, whether members of the central or local committees,
Well, he's saying they emerge from the masses in the course of class struggles and mass revolutionary movements. Yeah, so you have, you know, basically it's the people themselves. The leaders emerge, they are of the people, and they have the people's experience and consciousness and interests.
Yeah.
And so they're
which
one with
Gorbachev
the
people. Did not.
That's right. That's right.
People like Gorbachev and the new leaders whom Lenin predicted would act like that.
Yep.
Because, so Khrushchev, at the same time that he was saying Stalin had become divorced from the people, look at what he's doing.
Not only that, you know, in this letter from Mao, from the Central Committee, but Mao clearly had, you know, was his hand, describes Khrushchev as he criticizes the cult of personality as inflating himself and having those around him inflate him with a fake history that is nothing but a personality cult, only without the actual credentials warranting it, rather just fictional public relations writing. We'll pick it up next week. I want to stay on this at least another work, and we'll pick it up again. Luciana, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm really enjoying this.
Thank you, Don. My pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. As an old Chinese fable has it, as two tigers clash over primacy, a monkey may emerge as the benefactor or even the winner by simply staying up the tree. As China and the United States declare a lull in their trade war, should other players wait until they sort out their differences, or should they try to influence the outcome of this fight? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Brahma Chaleni, professor of strategic studies at the New Delhi-based Center for Policy Research. Mr. Chaleni, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us all the way from New Delhi.
Well, thank you.
Now, you remarked recently that in, quote, today's world, it seems strength respects only strength. Is that only in today's world? Hasn't that always been the case?
It's always been the case, but we have had this pretense of a rules-based order. And what we are seeing now is that pretense is falling. In place of a rules-based order, what we are witnessing is a power-based order, a new G2, because both China and the United States are pursuing aggressive unilateralism. America's defined unilateralism mirrors China's assertive unilateralism. So both believe in flouting international rules. So in this situation, a rules-based order looks like a mirage.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder if there is also a silver lining in this open flaunting of you know, international rules, because China and the United States seem like, to some extent, like a made in heaven, because they have a restraining influence on each other to the degree that no trade agreement could possibly have individually over them. Isn't that the case?
It is true, but it's important to remember how this situation arose. This close economic interdependence between China and United States emerged from a conscious U.S. policy from the 1970s onwards to aid China's economic rise. Successive U.S. administrations have aided China's economic rise. Ever since the 1969 Soviet-Chinese border clashes, the Americans decided to co-opt China against the Soviet Union, and that led to the Nixon-Kissinger opening in 1971. And that in turn led to America's decision to aid China's economic rise. For example, when President Jimmy Carter was in office, he issued a directive that all U.S. departments would assist in China's economic rise. So today, an economic rules-breaking monster has emerged in the form of China, which flouts international rules, which rides roughshod over global trading norms.
Now, both China and the United States, for the time being at least, have put the muscle flexing around tariffs on hold. But many American experts have been warning that this is just the calm before the storm. Do you think the current tension between Washington and Beijing can be frozen at its current state? Or do you think we're likely to see some escalation before waters calm down?
I agree that there is a lull, and this lull will not last for long, because the Americans have woken up to the fact that China now has a very one-sided trade relationship with the United States. It's very heavily skewed in China's favor. China enjoys a $370 billion yearly trade surplus at the moment. And this mammoth trade surplus of China is something the Trump administration is insistent upon reducing significantly. And if the Chinese play games, if they do not reduce the trade surplus significantly, we will see continuing tensions and even U.S. punitive tariffs being imposed against China. But what's important to note is this, that American allies like European Union, Japan, South Korea have fared worse than China in terms of U.S. actions. The Trump administration has been harder in pressing its own allies rather than in pressing China. The threat to impose punitive tariffs on China, that threat has been put on hold by Trump, but he has been coercing and shaming U.S. allies like Japan, South Korea, Canada, the European Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Cellini, I certainly want to go into the discussion of pressure against the so-called American allies, but let's focus on China more. As you pointed out, the United States has decided to take a pause for the time being, and I think a major part in that decision was this mysterious pledge on the part of China to increase the volume of American imports by $200 billion. I say this is a mysterious pledge because the Chinese officials say they haven't actually made it. Trump tweeted out about it as if it was a done deal. But regardless of whether or not they have agreed on that, do you think it's feasible? Do you think China can actually increase its imports from the United States by more than twofold?
It can, certainly, but not in a 12-month period. But if it makes genuine efforts to balance the trade relationship, it can gradually, over a period of 3 or 4 years, make the relationship more symmetrical. Right now, the relationship is very asymmetrical, and it's very one-sided in terms of who benefits more. Even though many American corporations and many American farmers have reaped handsome profits from the trade relationship with China, the fact still remains that this trade relationship is pretty lopsided. And Trump administration is right, in my view, in seeking to correct the balance to make it a more level playing field for the U.S. and for U.S. industries and farmers. And I think that's a legitimate goal to pursue.
Well, actually, that's a very, very interesting point, because I specifically wanted to ask you a question about farmers. As I'm sure you know, Trump has already tweeted out that American farmers should get ready to export to China as much as they can produce. And much of that $200 billion deficit pledge is supposed to be covered by agricultural exports. But you know better than I do that agricultural exports and subsidies is a very tenuous point in global trade. The Doha round of trade talks broke specifically because the developed countries did not want to dispense with that agricultural preferences, let's put it that way. I know that India played a huge role in trying to revive the Doha round of trade talks, and yet that wasn't successful. Do you have any concerns that this new way of deal-making, bilateral deal-making, and giving American farmers preferential access to a very large agricultural market will essentially make all the other international talks obsolete? Because essentially we have a comfortable twosome between a major producer and a major consumer, and everybody else seems to be on the side.
It's a very good question. It goes to the heart of the future of the global trade regime, because after the collapse of the Doha round, what we are witnessing is first the weakening of the WTO, second, more importantly, the emergence of overlapping trading blocks in the world. The world is getting segregated into overlapping trading blocks with their own rules. So any kind of a bilateral deal which gives American farmers preferential access to the Chinese market would further weaken the global trading regime, because this will raise concerns across the globe about, first, the fact that the U.S. subsidizes its agricultural exports. It subsidizes farm production to begin with, and then on top of that, it subsidizes its agricultural exports, and then it clinches a deal with the particular country, a large country, to secure preferential access to that country's market for its farmers. So this kind of wheeling dealing is not going to strengthen the global trading regime, is going to further undercut its objectives and its vitality.
Well, and agricultural imports are not the only thing at stake here. I've already heard some suggestions in mainstream American media that in order to fill this $200 billion trade deficit pledge, the Chinese may need to swap European goods for American ones. They may stop buying Airbus and buy Boeing instead, as if it was some exclusive twosome. If that were to proceed, I suppose the current trade would look like child's play.
The real American demand on China is not about farm produce. It's about high technology. Americans are concerned about China's Made in China 2025 program, which seeks to subsidize China's development of 10 critical technologies where the West, in particular the U.S., are way ahead of China today, including robotics, commercial jetliner manufacture, computer microchips, etc. So the American demand is that instead of China subsidizing this Made in China 2025 program, should be buying technology products from the American market. Now, this demand has not been well publicized, but this is at the heart of the negotiations, the negotiating strategy of the United States. They are trying to get China to stop subsidizing, stop underwriting this major technology initiative, and instead buy technology products from the U.S., in order to balance the bilateral trade. Because if the Chinese were to buy major technology products from the U.S. market, that would be a much better, surer way of cutting down the trade surplus than buying American farm produce, which even if they bought all the American farm produce, they will not be able to balance the trade to the satisfaction of the Americans.
Well, Mr. Cellini, and I think there could be legitimate questions about the fairness of such pressure, because if China wants to develop a high-tech industry, I think it should be able to do so. I mean, all the countries, India including, Russia including, the United States including, do help industries in which they see a potential. But my question to you is somewhat different. I wonder if you see any way of addressing the current disbalance in trade between China and the United States, or between the United States and other countries, in a way that would be fair to all and that would not destroy or significantly undermine the trade system that has already been suffering quite a lot in recent years?
It's a good question. Free trade is founded on fair trade. But free trade is not always fair trade. Free trade becomes fair trade only if the two parties involved have a power relationship that is matching. If there is a mismatch in the power dynamics between two parties, the trade relationship may be free in terms of free trade, but it may not be fair trade. So fair trade really depends on geopolitics. It depends on power dynamics. And that goes to the heart of this matter, that trade is not about trade only. Trade is largely about politics. And if the politics is not right for one party, then we will not see fair trade. So in this China-US relationship, the Americans still have an advantage. They are the more powerful country. And they're seeking to use their greater leverage to get the Chinese to accept their major demands. This is the dynamic at play currently.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Mr. Cellini, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Brahma Cellini, Professor of Strategic Studies at the New Delhi Based Center for Policy Research. Mr. Cellini, you wrote once, more than once, that India is a critical swing state, perhaps the most critical swing state in the world. When it comes to global trade at this point of time, do you see its interests aligned more with China, regardless of how tenuous that relationship is, or with the Trump administration?
Neither, to be frank with you, because with China, India has a very lopsided trade relationship. The Chinese trade surplus with India has doubled in the last 3.5 years to $60 billion, which means that every month, China is enjoying a $5 billion trade surplus with India. And more importantly, is the content of that trade relationship. The Chinese are dumping manufactured goods in the Indian market and buying essentially raw materials from the Indian market. So that trade relationship makes China anything but a partner of India. As far as the United States is concerned, because of American pressures on India, on the information technology industry, to give you one example, the Americans have not been very helpful, even though the U.S. and India have a close relationship now. But the Americans have been pressing India on several different fronts. They want India to cut down its trade surplus with the U.S. Right now, India enjoys a $29 billion trade surplus, which is less than half of what China enjoys vis-a-vis India. But the Americans are insisting that India cut down on that trade surplus. They're also wanting India to open up its economy to more American products. So India is facing multiple pressure. And on top of that, the Americans are trying to pressure India on Russia and on Iran through sanctions. So India certainly does not look at United States as a partner on trade.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's been presumed up until recently, at least, that global economy is not strictly quid pro quo. You know, I sell you, goods worth $1, you buy the same from me. Like, the general wisdom has been that it is more complicated than that, and you compensate the trade deficit by having other sort of relationships. But it seems that both Mr. Trump and to some extent you as well subscribe to this kind of, again, as I said, quid pro quo type of trade. Do you think that's the way to go for the future as far as global trade is concerned?
There has to be some degree of symmetry in a trade relationship. It's like relationships between individuals. If relationship between any two individuals is unbalanced, that relationship will not flourish. It won't be sustainable over the long term. Similarly, a trade relationship that is unbalanced, lopsided, unhinged, is not going to last forever. It's not going to last even 10 years. So there needs to be some degree of balance.
But Mr. Chalani, even in personal family relationship, determining that balance is extremely hard. It's not only about how much money somebody brings into the household or how many chores a person carries. I guess what I'm trying to ask you is whether you have any formula in mind for determining that balance for things that are not easily quantifiable.
Well, balance does not involve just numbers, the amount of goods traded. I'm not talking of just symmetry in that aspect. Balance is also in terms of how the two sides are benefiting from a trade relationship. What is the content of that trade relationship? Is it aiding the economic growth of both countries, or is it aiding more the economic interests of one country? All these factors together make the term balance. Balance is not just about the total dollar value of goods traded by each side with the other.
Now, speaking of other countries, the United States is set to decide next week on whether it wants to continue with tariff exemptions on steel and aluminum for the European producers. And it looks like the Europeans are not particularly holding their breath that they will be exempt for much longer. Do you expect that to change anything in terms of the global trade balance? Because you know that both the EU and the United States more often than not tended to be on one side when it comes to trade negotiations. You mentioned trade blocs before. Well, the developed countries used to be a powerful trade bloc. Do you expect that trade bloc to, if not to fall apart, then at least to be a little bit more fractured than it is right now if the United States indeed withdraws those tariff exemptions from the European producers?
Well, U.S. trade policy at the moment is a mess because Trump has created confusion on several fronts. He's created confusion in terms of its of America's allies, by refusing to permanently exempt the European Union, Japan, Canada from steel and aluminum tariffs. He has now threatened to impose tariffs on auto imports. And on top of all this, there is this looming threat of escalation of U.S.-China tensions. So right now, there's a lot of confusion in terms of U.S. trade policy. But what this confusion is doing is making America's allies rethink their relationship with the United States. For example, the transatlantic relationship, which has been the bedrock of Western security, that transatlantic relationship now is being openly debated and questioned in Europe.
Well, Mr. Chalani, as you may imagine, we in Moscow are not big fans of that transatlantic security relationship. We tend to think that it sometimes undermines security rather than strengthens it. But putting that aside, this state of disarray, do you think it presents any opportunities for countries to form, you know, cross cross camp ties? Because you mentioned before that up until recently, the trade negotiations were stalled primarily because of the trade blocs. Now there seems to be an opportunity to put that bloc differences aside and form something new. Do you think there is any chance of former U.S. allies or current U.S. allies and perhaps former or current U.S. Adversaries going together and trying to influence trade policies in the way they find fit for themselves?
what this tumult is going to do is going to make countries reshape their alliances, their trade alliances. They're likely to form new relationships. They're likely to reduce their dependence on certain countries, for example, and build greater relationships with some other countries. So we're going to see some flux as a result of what we are witnessing today. And this tumult is going to lead to a very different kind of a trade map in the years to come. We have seen a proliferation of free trade agreements bilaterally and regionally. And I think we're going to see more of these FTAs emerging as countries seek to shift their trade priorities and their trade relationships in a manner to create some stability in their trade policies and in their trade relationships.
Now, you mentioned before the threat of secondary sanctions stemming from the trade with Iran. I know that India has a good trading relationship with that country. So do the Europeans. But so far, what I'm hearing both from the Indian experts and the European experts is an idea that they need to go to Washington and negotiate some individual exemptions for themselves. I wonder if that is really an effective strategy. Are they being slow in forming those relationships, new relationships that you mentioned? Because from my point of view, it perhaps would make better sense to form a united front and negotiate with the United States on secondary sanctions rather than asking humbly for some individual exemptions.
Begging for individual waivers is probably the worst option that any country can pursue, because that will lead to even greater American pressure on that country to be subservient to the United States. Because any waiver that is granted to a country will come with conditions that further constrict that country's options. The fact is that whether it's Iran or the new act, the new American law directed at Russia, which is called Countering America's Adversary Sanctions Act, these laws and these sanctions are seeking to apply American sanctions extraterritorially. Extraterritorial sanctions are unlawful international law. They violate international law. They violate the UN Charter. They also flout the rules of the global trading regime. And to give respectability to these extraterritorial sanctions will amount to giving a blank check to Washington to set international rules for trade, as well as to set international rules for interstate relations. Countries have to speak up, because in the past, between 2012 and 2016, when the U.S. was applying sanctions against Iran on the oil front, most countries went along because the issue then was about restraining Iran's nuclear weapon ambitions. But now that the Americans have withdrawn from that nuclear deal, even as Iran was in full compliance with that deal, today the Americans do not have this kind of latitude to be able to enforce extraterritorial sanctions across the world. They'll have a harder time.
Well, Mr. Cellini, I totally agree with you. I just hope that they could not only speak up, but also act together. But anyway, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time and your perspective. And I hope our viewers can keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.